This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to ask a couple of interrelated questions that follow on the conversation we were having last night. They are about the notion of person or personhood. And then George is going to also ask a few questions, and then, as I said, we're going to open things up. So I watched the work again this morning. I have to say I liked it even more this time around. It's incredibly good. But we were talking last night about the fact that, first of all, this is a much more narrative film than anything Knut has done before. It almost seems halfway towards becoming a feature film, and I'm wondering if we have a feature filmmaker in our future sitting beside us. And also a correspondingly different relationship on the part of his actors to language and a different notion of personhood. And so I think that that line of questioning began with George insisting that I represent film and me reaching feebly back into the past. And what do film people talk about? They talk about shots, of course, and noting the closeness, the proximity of the camera to the face of the character and the implied interiority, but it's a strange kind of interiority. So I'm going to come quickly now to the point. In both the opening and concluding monologue, the central character says in voiceover, she speaks about the unease she has as a person. And in the second one, I jotted down some notes that I can't even read. She says, we understand what moves through us. Things that remain what they are while we have unease as a person. I'm paraphrasing it very badly now. The notion that the oil is related to these things that move through you as a person, as opposed to the world, the phenomenal world, which would awaken her from her oil slumber, so to speak. So I'm just throwing that unwieldy mass at you and hoping that you will tidy it up, since there's so much cleaning in your film.
Yeah, neighbor. It sets, I guess, that opening monologue and then the slightly changed end monologue. The opening one sets up some of the aspects of the film, or mentions them, or whatever, in the beginning. And one thing is, you mentioned the unease, so that I see is as the kind of, you know, the psychological digestion or response to the surrounding world. And so, and that's like the one that's like,
could I push you on that point beyond, yeah, as you say that you love George, pushing you beyond your comfort zone,
yeah,
doing that myself, yeah, and just asking you to dwell with the notion of being not just uneasy, but uneasy as a person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can come to that. I just want
okay
to finish my line of thought. I just want to say,
okay,
about in the beginning I talk about traffic, and the last one I talk about oil. So that's the shift in the beginning. It talks about the sounds of traffic and so on, and the thing that moves through us is the sound of the world around us that just moves and goes on doing what it does, and then kind of what we do, you know, and that this is what allows her to relax, you know, because it's knowing that the world goes on, but of course that's the kind of convention of the external world. So, and it goes on without the unease that she has. So it's like she isn't empowered or strong enough in a way to not have that unease she thinks this, or the surrounding world does not have, or I mean the kind of machinery of the world doesn't have. And the last one is just coined a little bit differently. So I mean, in the beginning it says I guess it's an acknowledgement of not quite knowing what it is, but in the last one it's going to say that we know what it is and that moves through us. So these kind of processes of the surrounding society. And then instead of saying traffic, it says oil. So that's my little tweak on Norwegian economy and so on. But you talk about you asked me about sorry, I'm a little bit slow today. But you asked me about the uneasiness, not as a
well, person, the notion of being uneasy as a person raises the question that personhood is somehow
because common. I mean personhood. It's a processual thing, so it's not something that's kind of static or steady. Even if we are comfortable or not in unease, it's through a kind of repetition of who we are in many ways. And we produce some of that, and we also are produced by our response to the surrounding society. So it's a kind of dynamic thing, and personhood is a kind of dynamic. Dynamics of subjectivity, and it's in negotiating the world around you, you go through. I mean, maybe some people feel at ease all the time, but I expect most people go through.
I think we've got a room of unease persons. So just one follow up question that in a sense is going to sound a little insistent on this particular point, because we haven't had personhood in the other works. I mean, the way George was thinking about it last night was in terms of class and your shifting relationship to the characters. I had to deal with having to do with the fact that suddenly, instead of representatives of highly educated bourgeois subjects, we have a working class figure, and why this sudden congealing of the notion of a person around her. I've almost come to the end of these irritating questions that I'm asking, but why should personhood be easier within this context, and what is a person? Okay. And isn't that begged by the film over and over again in many points?
Yeah, I don't think it's easier in this context, this kind of topical context. It's just a shift in my way of working, and I guess George's point yesterday in relation to the kind of the subjectivity in my previous films, and if you have seen them, you know that there are people from the actors are from from different backgrounds and genders, and their sexualities ambiguous sometimes, and so on. There are different types of subjectivity at play, you could say visually, but there is no persons, there are no kind of interiorities in terms of their characters. They don't have characters in that sense. So George's point with it being kind of white male subjectivity, I guess points to that the only kind of subjectivity that's maybe described in there is the one that comes from me, and so I guess that's the way I took it, because otherwise it wouldn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that would be then the effect of that there isn't any characters to the degree, if you think about it that way. But I think I've always been occupied with the ideas of subjectivity and trying to make room for different kind of attachments to subjectivity in the work, and that's something that's been through my work since the early 90s. But this is the first time I have person or more something towards character in the films. But not in first time I did do that in narrative. I mean, I've done that in radio plays before, but that's far back in the 90s. That's very different, because then, of course, the audio has to carry everything, and the kind of the projection of a person into just an audio work is maybe easier than when you have a relationship between the audio and the visual, the actor you're looking at. So,
George.
Okay, maybe I'll flip the coin and think about what I see as the other side of this project that's happened here at Penn, but also maybe for Knut's work over the long haul, as opposed to body, subjectivity, person, as we've been talking about it, architecture and space. and city and the urban. I just have a couple of observations. One thing I was struck by in the film that we see here is that, you know, in Knut's earlier work, I'm familiar with bodies of work. I'm thinking of a series of photographs Knut made about 12 or 13 years ago called Psychasthenia 10, which were photographs of architectural living dwelling places, mostly apartment houses, I assume, if I'm right.
Yeah, all the apartments.
Photographed at night in a way that architecture usually is not imaged, so that the structures were opened up or made more dramatic or mysterious or imposing or fragmentary by the very fact of their being imaged in the night. So we don't see the gas station, if I remember the film from my one viewing of it, as a structure in this piece, or do we? Or how did you approach thinking of this as a space to film, given that representing and evoking particular structures, architectures, and spaces has been so important to the longer haul of the work?
Mm.
Is that interesting to talk about? I could ask something else. If
No, I'm doodling because I'm thinking, not because I'm thinking
about
that.
No, I do the
that.
Same. I do the same thing. Yeah. That's why I don't allow myself to have a pencil.
I think it's just a shift, I guess, and it's also a different project. So in those photographs, I was interested in the actual buildings themselves, and it was also a response to German architectural photography from the 90s and the 2000s and so on, which had this.
You mean like the Becher School?
Yeah. So
school.
Yeah. So. So I chose another direction. I guess I wanted to try to mention some of the roles of these buildings within the city and their kind of urban subconscious and so on, without going to documentary photography and without going to this kind of large scale, large format photography, which kind of re-inscribed the kind of formal authority of the architecture in the photographic medium. So I had this 35mm camera, so it's kind of small positives. Actually, I shot it all in positive film. The camera I could carry with me and a tripod, and so it was an easy way of working. I didn't have to spend much time technically. Mm-hmm. And I shot them from the kind of adjoining open areas, which are part of their design. So anyway, that the buildings and representation of those buildings were more important. And here, maybe there isn't actually one shot where you see the building as in its entirety. But obviously, it's a specific architectural, social, economic context that's represented by the building, and you do recognize that even if you don't think about it. Mm-hmm. But you don't see the whole building, so it's more fragmented. That's maybe. A kind of development in some of the works I'm more occupied with fragments again, which I were also earlier, like in the late 90s in the video works.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe I'm stretching a little bit, but it seemed that the unrepresentability of the gas station structure, or the non interest in representing it as a structure, where that's been a motif of your earlier work, maybe it could be related to the kind of sculpture that you made on the campus, which seems to be itself about an intense fragmentation of structure and architecture and space. Is that something that's becoming more important to think about, to try to bring into the work to represent in some way?
It's something I do think about, and I'm not. I don't think about it in the sense that I think it's necessarily something that the audience will be occupied with, but in relationship to filming, it has several reasons. One thing is to kind of work against the kind of architectural documentary way of working, but still try to represent to a degree what these buildings are in their context, but without resorting to this larger framing zone. And then it's also relating to the conventions of artist filmmakers, which are, there are so many.
Who are you thinking about?
Films, well, Mark Lewis and others and so on. So you have the kind of slow tracking shots, and you have the kind of formal fixation on the buildings and the structures. And kind of heightening of their formal integrity and rigor. And with every film, I'm trying to avoid that as much as possible. That was also the case with Tripoli, which was very complicated to do because all the forms are so iconic. But I try to rather have them, for most of the time, just in passing or in a fragment and so on, rather than to frame on them and then just move slowly in or out or something.
Right. So it's not like Cassidy Dean.
Yeah. So I got a little bit lost of from your question, but this.
I was trying to bring it back to the sculpture over on the campus.
Mm.
You could think about that. I have one last question linked to these this line of thought, which is because we're sitting in front of this map, and the film is about a non-space or a public space in Norway. What about this urban space was something that you felt shaped the project? Philadelphia?
No, it did in a way, but I mean, I quickly realized I don't know anything about Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And even if I tried really hard to make something about Philadelphia in this, you know, relatively short span of time that you work on the project, at least, you know, so I would never have any real in-depth knowledge. So I got some information from Slav, then I think we got some imagery from you here, and then also my studio assistant worked on Philadelphia, and we built up. Yeah, try to think about it historically, and we were kind of assembling image archives and so on, and there were particular things that had interested me, which had to do with I guess economic traces in the streets, like to do with kind of buildings and or non-buildings and different sites in the city, the kind of traces, visual traces of economic or social history. So I was being informed by it, but of course there's nothing like that articulated into the specific work, and I think I would have probably only come up with something extremely banal and too simplistic if I had tried to make something like that. But looking at all these images also was what led me to some of the kind of ideas that developed first into this project and then into another project I just opened a month ago in Norway, which was looking at this kind of abysses and gaps left after buildings that have been torn down and so on. So it's a kind of, I guess, thinking about thinking about Philadelphia and the context led to some of the solution or some of the things I picked up, this idea of making a structure of a kind of economic ambiguity and so on, and came from thinking about this, but it's of course not specific to Philadelphia, and you can go somewhere else.
That makes sense, So I should stop, right?
Yeah, at least for a while.
I like when Kaja tells me what to do.
Yeah.
Happy to oblige.
So I'm stopping.
I mean, we can jump back in if at various points. Charlotte.
So thank you. I think we've been kind of circling around this question, but haven't really addressed it head on, which is the blackness and our question of race in your films, especially the ones we saw at High House.
Mm-hmm.
There was a comment yesterday about, you know, these are white 20-somethings, except they're not. And then the kind of blackness of the screen between scenes as a kind of framing device of each screen or an edge lamp of each scene. And I'm wondering, you know, obviously we've talked about class, we've talked about the capital, we've talked about, you know, social changes, but what does it mean to occupy an edgeland as a race body? Mm-hmm. And how is your film black? Or is there blackness in your film? And blackness is not, you know, the color of someone's skin necessarily, it can be an aesthetic. But I think, especially in the context of Philadelphia, we have Center City, and then we have our edge lands. And you know, I think your films, especially on Wednesday at High House, really made me think of that. And then because they seem just like white bourgeois 20-somethings, do we forget about their bodies?
But who is it that looks like white 20s? somebody.
This is a comment yesterday.
This was my comment.
Yeah, but in, you saw the films, right?
Yeah.
There was not.
Right,
it was,
but the
not populated
but,
mainly by.
But I
white,
think there are, then the reception of it is, or like some people perceive it as that they seem like white 20 something.
Okay.
Even if they're not.
Yeah.
And so, what is it? Were you thinking about that when you made your film? What it means to be a body marked as white, a body marked as black, and what does that mean to occupy an edgeland?
Okay. One thing I would like to separate out this idea of the kind of. Black is an aesthetic in terms of the kind of cut between scenes and the question of race, because I think that's at least I'm I think that in my film that's two separate things.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think maybe you have to think about the context of the films also, because I think in your shot in the European context it's different than here, so the issue of a black identity in Europe is not African American identity, so it's mainly African.
But I'm also
interested,
like, in the repetition of that.
Yeah, 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 sure.
In New York, and then in
But it's been an important thing for me, and it's also like as much as I haven't had persons and kind of characters in the films. It's an assemblage of actors that are kind of working on the film and delivering some lines, and quite often in some of the scenes it could be like a pool of sentences that just had to be said in that scene. It could be said by any one of them, so it's not that it belonged to a specific character. But at the same time, for me it made no sense to make a film that dealt with any kind of urban experience that I knew or experienced only with white characters, for example, but it's something that you meet very quickly as a filmmaker. And in the at least, I mean, maybe it's changed now, but when I started making films in which is not that long ago, at least it was it totally jumped on everyone that all the characters went white. So yeah, so it's just an example of this kind of presupposed neutrality of a kind of certain ethnicity or height or whatever you have of the actors. So these are mainly the actors I knew in the beginning that I liked to work with, and that stood in relationship to a kind of environment, an urban environment that was part of my world, and that. I was negotiating, and they also negotiating in their kind of everyday life. And in Europe, it became. I mean, later on, it became more specific. Like in Oblique, it's about a changing Europe, and you had kind of old structures and new structures and things outside. But so it was essential for me that the kind of bodies of these actors that were in there also represented kind of composition of people. That pointed to different backgrounds, which are also part of kind of urban environment and the changing urban environment and so on that I'm part of there. So in that film, it's you had the. I don't know, I was just thinking about this idea. I mean, I would be surprised if people really look at my films and think that they represent by 20 years or something, because frankly, they are spread across in age, and maybe this one there's more of that than the other films that are spread across in age and so on. You can discuss the role of subjectivity in the film, and in the case that it points to me, of course, the kind of narration of subjectivity. My subjectivity is also not just one thing, and it's but then of course it connects to that. But I mean, if you see the film, it's a wider discussion. But I'm not sure if why 20 years something is.
Yeah,
really
so I have to take back that comment. I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it was my inadequate way of trying to describe something that linked the earlier films that changed in this one, which was really about a change in class. But that one of the things that didn't get spoken about in the screening on Wednesday night was the changing city spaces, national territories in which you were filming, but what seemed to be a relatively unchanging, I mean, you use a cast of actors that comes back in the films, but a relatively unchanging set of class positions and persons, to use Gosch's word from the beginning. Now, and I mean, maybe a better word would be, like, and I'm, you know, one of the actors that Canute uses, I've been friends with longer than I've been friends with Canute, so it's a person from my life, and I know this person as a person, but she's the American actor, but maybe a better term would be something about a European subjectivity, a post-traditional or post-national subject, like the Eurozone subject.
And that was something.
I'm not trying to be insulting because you're European.
No, but it's important.
There's something about the project of subjectivity in Europe that's actually quite specific, and that many people have tried to think about and make either progressive or utopian claims for.
Yeah, because I mean that's very important, and that I mean when I made Filter City in New York, and then I made Bliss, which you haven't seen here, just afterwards, but that was still in a kind of urban situation, which was, you know, had some similarities. It was in Birmingham, which is quite kind of composite city culturally, so Birmingham, England. But then I made, so it was easy to handle this. And then I was invited to produce a film in Austria, in Salzburg. So within the kind of realms of this wealthy medieval city that had kind of kept wealth and kind of cultural authority for a long time, and so and then I brought in my set of actors again, and that was important. I wanted to kind of layer this idea of I mean, that was more specific, this idea of migration, immigration, and kind of new compositions of identities, together with this kind of long kind of historical lineage. And in Abyss, I was of course very important for me to have these layers, but also try to point to historical layers. It's for those who sit and watch the film, you can find it, but it's not really necessarily so much part of the narrative. But I'm trying to respond to you know, a lot of the kind of anti-immigration rhetoric and so on is always is trying to do two things. One thing is to set up some kind of idea of a kind of essence, identity connected to an idea of nationality. While most of Europe might have old cultures, most of the countries are actually fairly new, and this ideas of national identity that's going around is. It's very linked to the nationalistic movements of the 19th century and so on. So it's in the moment you look at it, of course, it just kind of disintegrates as a kind of claim of history or authenticity. And the other thing is that all of Europe's history is a history of migrations of people in through crisis or not crisis and so on. And that's how these cultures developed. So and cultural migrations and gene migrations and so on. And so, obviously, the kind of history of migration there, as other places, is just a kind of ongoing process of being habitable cultures and different social and economic and political developments. So I want to have it as kind of historical layers, but also just a kind of matter of fact thing of today. So also in Oslo, it would have been absurd to have just white Norwegian actors, because it's not the way that city is. And
Sheen.
This maybe goes back a little bit to Kaja's ideas about personhood, but this is something that's been brewing for me a little bit over the last few days, and it struck me particularly with Abyss, but I think there's some elements of it in this film as well. And it's this notion of types of looking and intersections of types of looking and what happens when those intersections occur. And so my observation was that it seemed like, particularly in Abyss, there were these moments where personal or intimate types of looking, whether it was someone looking at him or herself in a reflection or thinking about how he or she is seen or two people looking at each other who know one another. And then there's this anonymous looking, where it's walking around the city and people who don't know each other looking at each other, making impressions are made, assumptions are made, perhaps. And there were these moments where those types of looking, the anonymous and the personal, intersected. And when that happened, there was conflict, or there was aggression or violence. I can give you a few examples, like the one where the woman in Abyss was looking at her own reflection in the door, and behind her was the woman who was trying to make herself vomit. And then there's another moment where the two men were recounting these stories to one another, and slowly they started to kind of strangle one another. And so I was wondering what you thought was happening in those moments, and where these sort of forces are coming from, and what's at play there?
Well, I guess it's a lot like you're describing it. You can, and the effect of using these different ways of looking also allows then a different kind of confrontation with the. With the viewer, because you project different things into these looks. It's a bit like Kaja's comments yesterday on close-ups and so on. And you know, even if there's nothing particularly going on in the close-up and you just shot the person just looking around a little bit, you project different ideas of psychology into that, and then more distant look. But also more distant look also allows a different room of observation and kind of fantasy and projection. On the behalf of the viewer, so we did work with that. I mean, in Abyss,
there's some. Is that the title of one of your books? The Long Gaze and the Short Gaze.
Yeah, Long Gaze, Short Gaze. Yeah. So we also set up actors and so on in kind of positions far away. Before, I used to just shoot people wherever I could, but. Now I hear that I can't really do that anymore. So in Abyss, for example, we have these scenes of kind of some people in the distance and waiting for the bus and going on the bus and all this, and it's exactly to work on these effects that you're talking about. Now I lost a little bit your question, but you asked about conflict and what goes on in these scenes. You don't actually see anyone vomit, but you hear the story about
right,
it.
Right, yeah, a lot of these are just stories that are...
And then in that scene, when in the cafe scene, of course, we're kind of conflating or two different kind of perspectives or gazes, or lines of sight by looking at the people outside.
Right.
We start looking at the people in the cafe, and that's where the kind of narration happens. But then... well, we're hearing that these people come outside and they start to photograph each other, but towards the cameras you get these flashes going in the opposite direction, which also allows you to kind of to doze off a little bit from looking at the actors and just maybe hear the story in the background and then move back again. So it's you mentioned the outside and another context, a much more kind of trivial aspect. But a different kind of intimacy also, maybe those actors outside have than
right.
the ones inside. And sorry, that's my train of thought.
Andre.
I think my question and what I have been thinking about is actually very similar to Jean, so I'm jumping in at this time. And I think another way to ask Jean's question would be to shift from looking to narrative and ask you about the border, if there is one, between the mundane, the everyday, and the absurd, where, for instance, at the end of Edgeland, we have been watching a film where everything that does happen does have, you know, plausible isn't quite right, but it could happen in some form in this way, except for the very last scene, where clearly we are now in the space of the movie fully, and this would not be an actual occurrence. And there are several other moments where that happens too, where the two men who are talking in Abyss and all of a sudden they start fighting. Where sort of the general flow of life already all of a sudden turns into full-fledged art or film and leaves reality behind. And I was wondering how you engineer those moments, why they're there, how they function, how you pace them, and so on. And so forth.
No, it's something I'm quite occupied with. That's why I like the kind of narrative format, I guess, is to allow myself these kind of possibilities that you also have within literature. Of course, you can be on one page reading something that's you know, giving a kind of material observation of society at a certain point, and towards the bottom of the page you go into a hallucination. And in the kind of literature format, we're so used to these very different narrations or kind of relational spaces to be put next to each other, and it doesn't feel as it's problematic. And of course, in film, you can also do it often, but I mean, most films maybe pull you through one way of one space of experience or the other. But I quite like to put these next to each other. It's also about working with the viewer experience and like I talked about the other day, to work both with kind of immersion and distance in relation to whatever it is that goes on in the film. And then, so that's that scene with those two men that talk and then they fight or whatever. It's like a little kind of theatrical plateau put into something that's otherwise very realistic. For example, at least the first one where they're just walking through the market. Yes.
Roxana, and then Peggy.
Related question, that is, how does your archival work relate to narrative? Because in your talks you mentioned that the film Abyss came out of this photographic installation that you mentioned as an archive of migration. And then for now these more contemporary works, you mentioned that you have also been archiving narrative and actual speech acts of these groups of people. And so I'm wondering what happens to the archive voices of someone in transition, whether it's in age or perhaps in class, and also in migration across geography, when it's framed as a narrative? And also what does therefore narrative within film add to the archive, this kind of of course an archive is not static, but this kind of a concrete collection of entities.
Well, it's I think I'll also kind of demystify the archive bit, part of it. I mean, it's like you're working with anything. I'm sure if you're working with your artwork or your papers and so on, you have all the kind of resource and research material, and it could be just books, of course. And but in trying to work with specific sites and some relations between people or kind of social circumstances and so on, it's been good for me to build that material from actual encounters with people and visits to places and so on, and with me and all the people that work with me, and use that time to build up an archive where that I can that can influence the work and I can get ideas from and so on, and certainly also some narrative ideas or scenes and so on. So I guess I've taken that kind of research work maybe more away from more academic texts to more kind of research of my own, like, and so that's been a shift, I guess, and all the, and it influences a lot of things. Obviously, I can go around and see things and so on, but just be to hear stories, also narratives, fragments of narratives, and so on. And it's much more than actually ends up in the film, but has a very important role. But it could be just very small. It could be something like a part of a narrative that I think sets up kind of main problems of a piece that mentions people's everyday or kind of particularity of a certain situation. This is a kind of easy talking example. Like I mentioned, I made this film a few years ago. Actually, it was more like a video, there was this, and I was assembling stories from people, and everyone knew that they were kind of contributing towards this kind of narrative pool of this work, and that was part of the whole piece. Actually, it was traveling around and assembling stories, but I really wanted to work with work with the ideas of subjectivity and stories that relate to struggles that represented represented aspects of economic struggle, social struggle, and placement, and so on. So, and some more things. So anyway, among all these stories that I got, and you know, some people just wrote things like "I want to commit suicide" or you know, things like that. But I did get some fragments here and there, and suddenly I opened this one story, and it was about this man who had moved there. Well, actually, the first one that I opened was from this man, and he was there because his longtime boyfriend had moved to this city in order to get a new job, but he had also met somebody new, and it was so he was going through all these troubles. Like how was he going to resituate himself? How was he going to find love at that time in his life, and so on? And he wasn't living there, and he had to go back to the other city. But he was wondering what was happening in the relationship. And among the other sheets of paper I had was the story of his boyfriend that had come to the city and started his new life, and so on. He had found this new job and this, you know, new start in his life, and so on. And within those two stories, I mean, and the details of those stories, you had this kind of economic migration of which is part of, you know, everyday Europe as it is here. People move around because of jobs and so on, and the kind of possibilities and insecurities that they have, and also people trying to reassert themselves and find out where they are in their lives in relation to this, all these changes. So this became a kind of main structure in that piece, together with some other stories. But most of the time, it's smaller fragments. Anyway, long. Sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. It's a kind of rambling day.
Iggy?
Yeah.
The questions about looking and narrative make me also think about absorption and the role of absorption in your practice insofar as what it seems to me that you're not doing away with absorption, nor are you kind of obviously endorsing complete absorption. Mm. I was interested yesterday when you said that you dislike it when films are screened and it's kind of this, there's a lot, you know, you can walk in and out of the place. So there's this notion of immersion in viewing the films. Mm. But on the other hand, the neutral dark space of viewing conditions is obviously, there's a narrative dimension to it, one that has to either do with an industrial zone, this kind of non-site that brings into focus the proximity of bodies, particularly since it's very difficult to see them.
Yeah.
And related to that, in terms of viewing conditions, there's also the way that interacts with narrative, with absorption in the films themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, it seems to me that there are moments in which the characters, if we can call them that, are absorbed and they announce themselves so emphatically against the more diffuse, almost laconic interactions they have.
Yeah.
Specifically, I'm thinking about in Abyss, when the lead actress, there's a shot of her face, a close-up, in which she seems to be absorbed in something that we're not, by looking at something that we don't have access to, and that announces that it's so conspicuously different from how she is imaged in the rest of the movie that I'm curious about that. And in this recent film also, the scenes in which the lead character is looking out the window at the things that are going on are very much under the register of a kind of absorption as well.
Mm.
So I'm interested in the kind of way that you seem to be recalibrating absorption and the ways in which we might understand its critical work. Or
Yeah, I think it's something I'm going to continue to think a lot about, particularly now, and I'm about to make a much more narrative piece, and
yeah,
I think it's...
Yeah.
Pardon?
You are.
Yeah, starting work on it in 2 weeks. Or so.
And how long is it going to be?
About an hour and a half. Yeah.
So there we go.
But because it's, I might be mistaken, and I should think more about it. But I think there is what I've been trying to work with there has to do with a kind of criticality in relationship to the issues of the work. And I did one work in 97, which was structured wholly around that in terms of its edit. The Sacristania 2 and 3, which is this projection of kind of high capitalist architecture, glass architecture, and it's shot across some corners, so you can't really tell where the perspective is going, and then so on. But the whole edit is basically a kind of continuous shot on a tripod of the same thing, and it's doubled and so on. It looks quite hallucinatory, but in any case, it's cut up in many different fragments and inserted in small pieces of frames of black. And at times it's more monotonous, and so it's more distance from you. At times the kind of the rhythm in this kind of insertions of black are more rhythmic, and the experience becomes more you're more absorbed into it. It's more kind of oceanic and so on. So, and I wanted to work with the relationship to the image, in the case that sometimes you you lost your critical distance to it, and sometimes you are able to be more distance to it, and so on, and move between these positions. And that's a strategy I took from electronic music, ambient music, and so on. Well, ambient music in the 70s, late 70s, was occupied with this idea of being a backdrop, and so on. By the late 80s, early 90s, it had worked very well with the kind of dynamic of spatial dynamic, where you, sometimes the music is really kind of almost situated in your body, and then other times it recedes back more into the space, and so on, as a kind of spatial effect of this music. And it has to do with kind of rhythms, speeds, or just purely sounds and frequencies, and so on. And that also allowed some people to try to work more critically with music, like to work more politically, for example, through fragments and speeches and so on, and try to position it differently in relation to your body. So these were things I adopted into my film practice, and I want to work in a way where people are allowed critical distance to what they are looking at. But at the same time, I don't want to just position them in one position either. So I also allow that kind of narrative absorption at some points. I think it's a key thing, and I don't really have an answer on how to develop it. And but it's also something that works against just following a film through smoothly. It makes it a bit more difficult to watch it.
Early works, you do have this play in your work with extreme, like, consciousness-losing states of absorption, like hypnosis. Mm. Or the Sacristania video you were just talking about, it's like a stroboscopic effect that you could describe as making you more attentive to it, but it's also a kind of experience that's,
destabilizing.
Destabilizing.
And it moves, but I tried at least to make it so that it kind of moves between, because that stroboscopic thing is not the same way all the time. Mm-hmm. So you think you're watching it again, the differences are subtle, so you think you may be watching the same thing again, but it's getting more boring or more still and so on. And then there's like slight accelerations or shifts, and then makes you pull more into it.
But absorption I don't know how you were using the term absorption. Absorption is obviously a term you can't use in an art history seminar.
He knows that.
Okay. Yeah. Without certain writers and voices and histories coming to the table. And so, you know, that obviously there's been claims for the great sort of emancipatory and modernist claims made around that kind of subjective attentiveness. This is not the experience of hypnosis, I don't think, nor is it the experience of trance. I mean, that seems to be part of the work in the early years for you.
Cluster praxis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was, you mentioned the Sacristania series photographs, and the film I mentioned is the Sacristania video installation. Which the title refers, of course, to Roger Calloa's essay on mimicry and legendary Sacristania, which I insist that you gave me, but you seem to think you didn't give me, back in like 94, 95. In any case,
we worked with the Independent Scholars Program together.
Yeah. And but in any case, what struck me there, apart from it being a fantastic essay, and it starts up with describing morphology and mimicry within a kind of zoological world, into talking about kind of cultural and psychological condition and so on. But in any case, this kind of you see psychasthenia as a kind of crisis of the borders of subjectivity, of borders between personality and space, and where you are being kind of seduced and absorbed, so to say, or immersed. You're being desubjectified, but also you are kind of driven into another subjectivity that doesn't belong to you. It's that one of the context or the space or the place and so on. And of course, in itself, it's not necessarily something necessarily progressive or anything. But this is just the way many things are working. That's why you have architecture that's totally dissolving itself and the borders between itself and the surrounding. Well, we have it within drug culture, certainly, and music and other phenomena. So it's kind of exists across the board. Also, kind of decentralization of capitalism and so on. Like the borders between one thing and another is not so given anymore. So
I
that became a kind of.
I think that's still there in this new work. That was why I was asking about personhood. Things flowing through. Being uneasy as a person because there is still this porousness somehow. But sorry, I interrupted. Did you finish answering? Do you want to say anything more to Iggy? I interrupted
you. No, it's okay. I was more or less done. I would probably say the same thing, a couple of new sentences, and then I stopped.
Miriam. Miriam and then Sam.
Yeah.
I'm also interested in sort of intersections of different ways of looking, but perhaps more literally, to return to the sculpture here on campus. I was very intrigued by a comment you made last night about the enclosure walls sort of invoking a foundation, an incomplete foundation, and that to me would seem to indicate a kind of vertical permeability, so that when we walk into the enclosure, we are both sort of below as well as within. And so I'm just intrigued whether you think about the sense of porousness and permeability across your different media of working in both horizontal and vertical terms.
I have to think about that.
You definitely made sculptures early on where you had to go underneath things.
Yeah. No, that's true. And one of the things I liked about this was also to kind of inverse this idea of sculpture on the plinth. So make something that, even though this is up on top of the ground, it's almost like kind of basin where the sculpture is inside. So so in more like a kind of formal terms, yes, certainly. And the installation that George refers to, actually called Heterotopia, we should comment the other day, it's a piece that's meant to function in a group exhibition situation where the other artists works and the other artists can have their works on top of mine, which is basically like a platform, and you might walk by it without noticing that there is this video installation underneath. But if you see it, it's a kind of space of withdrawal. You have to bend down and go inside it. And so that was probably not a very good answer.
Well, I guess I'm just curious if that sense of verticality, the porousness of verticality, plays a role somehow in the way that you're constructing your films as well, because there is such a sense of this kind of lateral movement between surfaces and spaces, with ways of looking, etc. But I think a lot of the sort of abstract notions that you've been describing about whether it's class formation or personhood might indicate a kind of vertical movement as well.
Abyss in the notion of falling.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In terms of, but maybe not so permeable. It's a vertical orientation, but I think it's not necessarily so easy to negotiate. And then, or some of it happens not necessarily in the way you want it to happen. So it's a permeability that's maybe not of your own design.
But an absolutely impermeable subject would be a truly horrific thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Personhood is a tricky thing.
Yeah.
Sam?
I'm struck by the way Tripoli and Egress ended. I was curious about the character discovers a handgun and then lays down, moves from vertical to horizontal. Mm. And then at the end of Egress, the figure is flooding her immediate area with gasoline. Mm. And there's like this strong implication of violence in both of those acts, and they both conclude as it happens. And I was just wondering if were you thinking about conclusion in similar terms in both films, or?
Yeah, I might have done without realizing it. And in Tripoli, it was it's the kind of moment where the kind of environment and the history and the kind of latent violence kind of catches up with him in a way. But it's also a moment where he kind of relaxes towards the end. And but I see this strong formal relation.
And the notion of soothing, the strange juxtaposition of the violence with comforter.
Because that's also in Egress. Yeah. You know, it's like it's a release for her, of course, at the same time it's an act of violence, and if it's to be taken literally. Yeah.
Erica?
This is kind of a half thought, more than a question, so forgive me, but I've been thinking about your titles, and I've been thinking about especially what you just said a few minutes ago about the importance of Calvois to your early thinking, because I was noticing that there are sort of two different, I was focusing on two different ways that characters' personhood or the question of a kind of overwhelming experience happens, especially with regard to either architecture, which seems like in the films that we watched on Wednesday, a kind of similar to oil as like this thing which is the means by which capital sort of continues to move, or the, so I was thinking about, on the one hand, there's a kind of like capitalist sublime, forgive the terrible phrase, but I don't know exactly how. I kind of keep coming back to the sublime and abyss maybe
there,
you know, and this idea that like you're standing in front of this space, and it's not just the physicality of the space, but it's this kind of like sense that money is making these changes happen, and it exceeds anything that you can kind of hold on to in terms of perception. And then there's this other idea of like egress and kind of going out of yourself or kind of spacing out in a kind of way that Calvois talks about space, where you're kind of becoming the space, or you're losing yourself in the space or something. It's not really a sublime, not quite the same way, but these two things seem to play out as intention throughout your film, and they're both ways in which you get to a kind of, I wouldn't say a crisis of subjectivity, but there's a place in those where you come up to the edge your sense of boundary, that's like what you are as a person, is somehow put under duress. And it's, like I said, not really a question, but I wonder if this, what I'm saying, is in any way resonant with your thinking, or if there's a response that you would have.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I guess it's maybe linked a little bit to Kaja's comment just now. I mean, in my films, I see kind of the subjectivities as processual and not stable, so then it's kind of producing and being produced at the same time continuously, and of course I can make a work that just kind of exemplifies that, just talks about that, which is not really what I'm doing, but I'm using that in the ways I try to use that in ways of making the kind of characters or actors relate to their surroundings, so it's not, they don't have just a kind of given position, for example, of like continuous critical distance, for example, but it shifts. Sometimes they have, sometimes they don't have it, or something. And this process then, you know, is kind of process that we all have all the time, but that sometimes they meet critical boundaries. And so, yeah.
Mashik.
Just picking up on this this subject of perceptual subjectivity, since we were discussing absorption a few minutes ago in its many forms, I was curious about the role of theatricality, and particularly Homé was bringing up the Brechtian you mentioned in a lot of your earlier films, and I'm curious specifically about how language use operates in constructing, how language usage operates in constructing this kind of Brechtian theatricality of subjects and formation, and seeing, you know, actresses jump out of train compartments and sort of announce themselves as theatrical personas who have arrived to deliver a monologue and then disappear again. And agents, you know, they don't seem to be agents of their own language usage, and particularly considering that some of these films come out of poems you mentioned, and so they're
Non-Brechtian theatricality, but the theatricality.
I'm very occupied by theatricality because it I guess I like the way it reveals the whole kind of setup and acting and so on as constructed and as dealing with conventions, like as of course any acting does. And but of course there are many different types of theatricality, and you can use it in a way where you're actually referring to it, so that when people look at it they think, oh, this is theatrical, or this is about theatricality, and so on. In as far, and it has changed also a lot during my work, but it's in Filter City I set it up very deliberately, you know, that she walks around next to this person and talks loudly, you know, and so on. To us, while the person next to her is kind of acting as if she doesn't hear it. But so I like this, I guess, this kind of visibility of the form, of the constructed form, which, you know, it can render it very kind of pathetic and so on, but it can also give it some kind of integrity sometimes, because it's kind of revealing what it is at the same time. And I really enjoy working with theater actors because they are so, compared to the traditional film actors, they are not particularly interested in kind of realism and so on. They're very occupied with kind of language and bodily expressions and so on as a kind of creative manipulated form. And there's a lot of similar interest between theater actors, I think, and me. At first, I was totally terrified of theater actors because of just this, you know, the kind of ideas of theatricality and so on. But theater actors can have such an incredibly intelligent relationship to conventions, which is great to work with, I find. But in relation to how to work with that in a longer piece, I'm not sure. I haven't made such a long piece before, but it's something I think a lot about, because I have to hold the viewer's attention much longer, and of course always such a long stretch, each scene might lose some importance. I can't just construct a film out of just a few scenes, but the kind of narrative structure has to maybe hold more of the attention. But at the same time, I feel my approach to filmmaking is, as coming from as being an artist and so on, I'm very engaged and interested in working in relation to conventions, and sorry, I got a bit stuck there, but
so the question of the theatrical brings us back to personhood, and those two things are hard to think together. the theatrical term would be persona.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
I like the idea of an uneasy personhood myself.
Mm.
I would not want to be around easy persons.
Yeah.
But there's no chance, there's no risk of that. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
I'm from the outside a bit.
That's okay.
Yeah. But I'm excited to grow up and talk about these things. So I apologize, I've not done proper research or anything like that. But I'm coming from architecture. And I'm interested in the conventional is very interesting, and I've not seen the films, but I'm interested in whether if one is a comment on the other, or the other is a comment on the one, in the dialogue between the film that was generated and the work that was generated. If at all. I believe, don't know your name, but the question about the gazes and the intersection.
Jean.
Jean, I thought, started to address that relation, and I'm not sure if really is leaving personhood, but talking outside of sort of the subject.
So your question is if the relationship between the film and this installation, or the public work, or
the public work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are different connections. One thing is this kind of fragmentation of architecture, but still using architecture, or kind of signifiers of architecture. Within the works, so that's similar. And the other thing would maybe be in relation to subjectivity, more kind of fragmented subjectivity, maybe. I mean, but there are obviously the other connections because they are developed at the same time. So yeah, I'm sure I could find more things maybe on the kind of formal level over time.
George, you may speak.
Yeah.
Must I speak?
Please. I know you have to leave soon, so.
No, I was listening to Canute think about connections and thinking about this question from the architecture person. I just was so struck by the use of the chain link fence as a sculptural material.
Mm.
And would love to talk more about the metaphorics and the structural possibilities. I mean, so we have this material that's used to create boundaries and to incarcerate and to keep people out, it's a barrier, and yet in the sculpture it becomes something that we see through, and that is like a screen, but not a screen, more like a lens.
Mm-hmm.
And the sculpture becomes most, for me, in experiencing it, there's many different experiences the sculpture seems to produce in its viewer, but for me it becomes most beautiful when those planes interpenetrate, like that moment of density, which is the pivot of the different planes.
I agree.
Yeah, you could talk about like constructivist sculpture, but that actually is the moment, a real beauty in the piece for me, when this thing that's supposed to be about barriers becomes a structure of this. You know, I mean, it literally is made of a mesh, but when it actually does that.
It's the interweaving, I totally agree, the interweaving of the different layers, which is a carrying over of the weaving principle that happens within each one into the relationship between them.
Right.
I don't think it's about the material of fences at all.
Really?
You know? I mean, I think what you're saying is that it's very much about when that material ceases to be material.
Yeah.
And starts to sort of activate itself in another way. I mean, I think that it is not material. It is the sort of that moment at which it becomes not material, which is in the subject, that it becomes a reality. So
yeah.
I think that it is not material.
But don't you think it's I mean, just the very gesture of making this interpenetrated, like exploded structure out of a fence. I mean, that's the most simple way I could put the contrast of forms of that form. I don't know. I mean, I think it's important that it's fencing, even though it transcends that function. It's not functioning that way. clearly it doesn't want to, even though it seems to want to at times in the way you use it in installations.
Yeah.
You create rooms, you create barriers, you create problems for the spectator to move through and around in a different way.
It's undoing everything about fences that make a fence a fence. It's some radical transformation. That is really wonderful.
And it doesn't want to talk about it.
No, I'm thinking about it. I mean, I think this transformation that happens maybe in the sculpture here, I use it much from how they function, and it's a very, apart from having those connotations of, you know, separating the spaces around us that we know of, it's also a very kind of economic and easy material to just define spaces.
Yeah, like a certain schoolyards.
Yeah, a certain relation to bodies. So I'm making these kind of enclosures where, with different kind of intimacies or not intimacies. For example, relation to the screen, mm-hmm. instead of having the screen just there and you can sit wherever. So it's creating different kind of limitations for. And possibilities for the body, and at the same time it's see through and optical. So, in that way, I'm using it exactly from how it is used as a material. But of course, in the sculpture, it's this transformation where it kind of
complete
it's
transformation.
Both fence and kind of dissolvement of fence.
The relationship between the wall and the fence is obviously very interesting and. The terms that we've just been talking about. But for some reason, every time I think about the transformation, I recall a fenced-in area in my neighborhood where there was a terrible fire that removed some low-cost housing that was probably arson and evacuated a huge number of people the first year I was living here. And then it was fenced, all the rubble was removed and it was fenced off. And it is just, it becomes more and more of a blight every second. Nobody can get it. There were many people who were rendered homeless as a result of this fire. And it's just the arbitrariness of the fortification, the way that it's just subtracted from a neighborhood that needs it is. So in a way, what you're doing with the fence is the undoing that your work does includes the undoing of that kind of removal of a large space from a neighborhood, subtraction. But it remains with an X through it, or it remains but in a canceled out way. Mm-hmm. Andre and Marika.
I had a question also about your sculpture. Particularly the space that sort of becomes a dead end space. So looking at it from the side that's closest to Fisher Fine Arts Library, there's a space that kind of comes to a dead end, and then if you turn around, you're still able to access the sculptural part in the center. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about this idea of including it in the work in terms of accessibility and inaccessibility, and then going back to George's point yesterday about being, what he said yesterday about being in the Rodin Museum and looking at other viewers and what this special space might do to a context of multiple viewers being in and outside the work.
I worked more explicitly with that before in other works where I was making this what I called narrative installations in the 90s, and that was the kind of narrative component was really only to do with the kind of relationship to other to other bodies, other viewers, and so on in the space. So so for example, in darkened spaces where you can't see so easily, people's faces is like kind of erasure of subjectivity. So people become more kind of they take on, you project onto them also kind of subjectivity or identity and so on. So that's been something that's been part of the work very explicitly before, and here I guess I didn't think so much about this kind of group situation of relation to people, but certainly about this thing of making this kind of dead ends and opennesses and different kind of pockets of proximity to the sculptures. You have one roll of it from the distance, and then you have But when you come close to it, you kind of have to go inside to see the one. Then it's almost too close to see the whole form. And then it's more about this kind of bodily movement around it, where there are some kind of closures and stoppages and other opennesses.
The wild thing about that space is the more you partition it, the more space you seem to be creating. It was It was as if the partitioning was doing the complete antithesis of what I was describing a moment ago, which is the subtracting space.
Mm.
I like that about the wall very much. Any other questions? Andre, that's right.
Can I ask you both, and Kaja, what you would say the uneasy person's erotic expectations are in your movie? You were just talking about intimacy, which is, I think, or correct me if I'm wrong, not exactly a term that is ever explored thematically in your movies, or at least not physical intimacy.
Mm.
And then obviously I've been puzzled all through, especially Wednesday, but also in Edgeland, by the kind of latent homoeroticism of it all.
Mm.
And it seems almost the only viable erotic option in the universe you are portraying. Right, and that's, I think, is a very radical proposal that's at the same time terribly frustrating and liberatory at the same time, right? And reflecting on the same conditions of wanting sameness and living through sameness perpetually that at times can get broken or interrupted and so on. And I think the kind of sexual metaphor, sexual subtones with your generalized worldview are quite potent. And I'm just wondering what you would say about especially the latent homoeroticism of it all.
Mm.
If it's there.
Yeah, I in the 90s, I guess one reason why I started to work with Opry, with this actress I worked with for a long time, was in these audio installations and radio narratives, because she had such a kind of androgynous voice. So when you listen to it, you didn't necessarily know it was a man or a woman. So for the listener, you could take the kind of direction of desire in that piece in different directions, because she could mean different things in the film. And
I never realized that about Oakley until you say it.
Yeah. Okay, but if you just listen to her voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very deep.
Mm.
And very commanding.
Yeah. And so I was occupied with trying to set, I don't know, different possibilities of sexuality or not lock it down to one type of, I guess, identification for the viewer. But that's, of course, easier just to do when you're not seeing anything. Later on in the other works, I think it's different from work to work, but sometimes I would set up some kind of erotic possibility or something in the film, and often when I wrote the piece, I didn't necessarily know if one character would be a woman or a man and so on also, and I didn't really necessarily think that wasn't important for me. And then so sometimes it's been more accidental, and other times it's also been for example more thematic, like you say. I mean, a kind of but also to create a kind of ambiguity between characters, like what their relationships are, like if they're friends or lovers or acquaintances and so on, so they give these different possibilities of projection into the work. And but yet in also, like, in some cases I've involved a kind of man-woman dynamic, and other times I have not tried to do that because it's not something I thought that I, and the sexual or erotic man-woman dynamic, because I didn't think it was necessarily relevant to the piece and the kind of direction of desire in the work didn't have to be so locked. So, yeah.
Well, the relationship of female pairing in Abyss, for example, was a really strong aspect of that film.
Yeah.
There are male pairs, but they seem to struggle and fight more than desire.
Mm.
But the female pairs, while they argue, they also desire that, you know, they fight and then desire, like the hold-up scene where Oakley demands the money from the one young woman who then becomes obsessed with her.
And the ending is, the ending is, yeah, pretty fantastic. But it, but there is a kind of intimacy in that ending.
I have to ostentatiously interrupt your seminar and say goodbye, because I have to leave.
It's so good to see you.
Yeah, you too.
Fantastic. Asha, thank you so much.
Thank you for
making it possible for me to be here.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Yeah, it's nice to meet all of you. Thank you. Yeah. So I'm not just leaving because I want to.
Yeah, right.
Iggy.
I guess also like related to this topic of sexuality and male-male and female-female parents, I'm interested in the continued references you make to gay cruising, which I believe is also strongly felt in these industrial zones as a space that hosts cruising, at least in the United States, after parks are policed. And also the continued interest in it as a space for promiscuity, primarily associated with gay men, at a time in which cruising, due to different technologies, is kind of vanishing as a practice, or as fully vanished, outside of my realm of experience. but I'm interested in that kind of But I'm interested in that continued interest in that, and whether those dynamics are also informing the public sculpture, because it would be powerful to put those kind of illusions in a public sculpture at the center of a university, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, I think it's different. I mean, in the 90s, I worked specifically that almost part of this way of dealing with kind of spaces of deviation or crisis within the city, and also within the kind of city's subconscious, the part of the kind of narrative and experience spaces for some and kind of projected spaces for others. So, for example, the park at nighttime is the reason why I use that is that it allows these other kind of behaviors that can't happen in the park in the daytime to happen. It's kind of this temporary zone. So you have cruising, I mean, mostly you have drug trafficking, you just have kind of loner hangouts, or you have people doing all these kind of different behaviors that they can do there in the park, either social or antisocial or sexual or other things. So that was connected very much to that. And then I was trying to set up with this kind of narrative installations in the 90s to try to use that kind of dynamic for people's projections of fantasy and desire into the space by using kind of strategies from sex clubs or nightclubs and so on. I mean, simple things, just like a series of booths, dark lighting, very reduced lighting, but also create a kind of architecture, which was one that you'd have to spend some time in, so you kind of got assimilated into the space. When you first walk in, you can't see anything in this, as if space looks back on you, because you sense these people, but you can't see things clearly. After a while, you become part of this kind of subjectivity of the space, projections from others. So then I made this park installations, nighttime park installations, only on the road. On their own, and then later with films in them. So that was a more kind of thematic I worked with specifically in the 90s. I guess with this piece, I didn't think about it in that way. But it is a space of kind of both the closure and openness and so on. Even though the walls are very low, so I don't know what kind of role it would have.
Are you talking about the public piece?
I'm talking about the public work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know that it was occupied last night because there were beer cans all over when I went to look at it today.
Yeah.
Charlotte.
I wanted to maybe connect the title of Edgelands with your practice as both filmmaker and artist, both and not either anymore. And if you, you know, it feels feel as if your practice occupies kind of the edge lands of each as a filmmaker, as an artist, how your work occupies those edge lands, and what that can mean for the kind of more social, economic, racial edge lands that you delineate. Or the public, the edge lands of the public.
Yeah. I guess it would probably be quite pretentious of me to think that I'm occupying the edge land of my practice, but in other ways, I am working both within the art context and the film context, and slightly in between. So in the kind of art context, my films seem very much like film, and in the film context, they seem very much like art. So, and that's a space I think is quite useful. One thing it allows you to step outside the conventions of one kind of institutional reference world for your practice, and look at it through another institutional reference world, and then back again, and so on, and then so it allows a kind of differences of reflection on my practice. The edge land title for this show is not one particular piece, but it's like for the whole show, came from the interest in this idea of edge lands of urban environments and so on, which is this kind of zone, this kind of unregulated, unkept zone, just as kind of edges of developments before you come to the next thing, and so on. So it's been written a lot about in relation to England, where that's the real wilderness of England. That's like the only kind of wild zone. But of course, it's a little bit like a kind of heterotopic site, in that it kind of reflects back to the kind of priorities and economies of the surrounding society, because the kind of degree of how it appears to be not governed or in control and so on. Whatever traces are, if it's totally filled with garbage or not, or these kind of things, tells a lot about the surrounding society. But I think your question is more about this kind of social or geographical outskirts of a city, more the kind of a habitable space of the societies there.
Yeah, so but I mean, in this kind of uncontrolled space of the edge lands, is there a kind of freedom in the uncontrolled? Are you in a space where we're still developing a language to make sense of the differences or the non-differences between film and art in this?
I want to say something quickly here.
Yeah.
I think that Detroit would be a very glaring example of the way in which cities can be hollowed out from within, and the center turned into an edge land. And I was very struck when I was watching Egress this time around by the central role that highways and their for oil play in terms of cutting up cities and turning centers into edge lands, and that seemed to be working quite dramatically in the case of Egress.
And then these spaces, of course, take on different meaning in relation to different people, basically. Like, there's some of the areas, some of the kind of edge land around where we shot the film, which isn't quite at the edge land, but that kind of starts just beyond. I talked to different people in the area, and for some people it was like, oh yeah, that's a great place to go for walks and so on, I go for the dog. And then for others it was like, oh yeah, that's where the drug dealers hide their stash. And it's the same, you look at the same piece of just like some kind of bushes and grass and so on, but it had total different meaning. But it allowed both those kind of functions, yeah.
And we could bring Philly into the conversation, and Penn specifically. The university has bought a large plot of land that is an edge land, and which is not very safe. This is the area that I'm hoping we can resituate your work at some point in time. It's so unsafe and so difficult to get to that they're going to wall it in eventually, which would make your work a wonderful meta-commentary on that practice. So there is a quite intimate connection between this project and that, and that makes the that as a destination even better. Iggy.
I have a technical question.
Yeah.
As somebody who, like, I don't have a lot of competence in the technology in general, but in relationship, so you worked in video and you also worked in 35 millimeters and also using transfers to high definition for editing. And I'm interested in knowing more about the relationship of technology to working in low light conditions, internal conditions specifically, and also specifically interested in how you obtain very important scenes for you in both this film and in Abyss, which are nighttime scenes in which we're looking through a window, and it's not just that there's this relationship between the luminosity of the interior and the darkness of the city that we're looking at, but there are also those spectral reflections of the inside that kind of permeate, that highlight that diaphanous dynamic that Kaja was talking about. I'm specifically thinking about all the scenes of the fight in this last movie, the scene in which Okoye is in the gym at night, which has a very different valence to when she's in the gym in the morning, and also the cafe scene. That seems to me, like, how was that made technically? Was there any kind of post-production involved?
So that might be a topic for a one-on-one conversation. I don't know.
I can answer it really quickly.
Okay.
If people are interested. It's obviously all to do with the lighting. And you have to work with something that has a really great dynamic range, so meaning that you have many stops, say, from white to black or through the colors. So you have lots of possibilities of graduation. So then you have to shoot on something that's really high quality. So say, like 35 millimeter film or new digital film formats. You know, I shot this on Aggreson 5K. And then it's then it's really just about it's a lighting question. You have to light some element in you have to have enough light to see the characters, but not too much light so you feel in the environment. Yeah.
And is there any kind of post production?
No, that's the other thing. I like to shoot things as much as I want them right when I shoot them. I prefer that. I mean, you can do anything in post-production, of course, if you have the kind of enough detail in the image to do so. But I prefer to try to shoot it the way it should look in the film, and also creates the right environment for the concentration of the actors, and then also all the photographic crew, and so they know what they're actually dealing with. So, yeah.
Well, then let's thank Knut Norman.